behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bullen.
Ben, we are back from, I don't know, should we even mention this or not?
But yeah, let's mention it.
A little bit of an illness.
Yeah, a little bit
of a vacation, some holiday stuff. So we're back now. Everything's going so-so. I've got, I'm on the mend still. How about that?
Yeah, you're on the mend. And I got to tell you, man, it is good to see you because you were the one who was walking through an illness. I always kind of seem to have a low-grade illness that makes my voice sound weird. I don't know what that's about.
Yeah.
But you're sounding a little Ben Bolin-ish today.
Oh, no. I'm always a little sinusy, a little nasally sounding, but even more so today. So if anybody's picking up on that, that's what's going on. I'm going to push through this one. We're going to do okay. I promise. But we've got a great topic, though.
Oh, yes, we do. This is a great topic, and this is a listener suggestion.
That's right. It comes from Rudy Smith. And Rudy, as we've mentioned in several of our podcasts, several of our nuts and bolts type podcasts, mm-hmm. He writes in often. He's a prolific writer to us, and we love that. I mean, he always has some great ideas. One of the ideas that he came up with was jet sprint boat racing, or sometimes it's called sprint boat racing, or jet sprint. But he mentioned that, you know, he had found kind of an unusual design of a boat online somewhere. I think he was just kind of cruising around and saw some strange looking boat with a roll cage or roll bar rather, and not a big prop sticking out of the back or anything. Kind of
right.
A short boat, two people, very fast. Didn't know anything about it. Wanted to find out what was going on. So he kind of poked around a little bit and found out that it was part of this racing series called Jet Sprint Racing. And I would bet that a lot of our listeners have seen this, but don't know really exactly what it's called or can place it until we mention exactly how it's run, because I think they'll picture it right away.
Yeah, you'll recognize it if you haven't already clocked it. But if you were one of our listeners from New Zealand or Australia, then you already are well aware of this. A little bit of background to get into jet sprint and sprint boat racing. This comes from New Zealand, from a fellow named Sir William Hamilton, or Bill to his friends. He was developing the jet boat in the 1950s.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it goes back a bit. He was born in 1899, I believe. And he never took credit for inventing jet propulsion, marine jet propulsion. He always credited Archimedes. So, you know, classy guy. And he was the founder of one of the leading water jet manufacturers, CWF Hamilton Limited. So in the 1950s, he sets out, he's trying to build a boat that can navigate shallow, fast rivers, which we will later find is very important, right?
Very, very important.
So the problem with a shallow river is that if a river is too shallow, then propeller-driven boats can't really get through because the propeller will scrape the bottom of the river, right?
Obviously.
So he started trying to figure out how to get something that wouldn't rely on a propeller and therefore could work in a shallow place with a riverbed, you know, just a meter or less around there.
Sure.
And he came up with this idea of having a jet boat that draws in water from under the boat and then expels it out through a nozzle.
So, Ben, I mean, this is really, if you want to get down to brass tacks here, this is like the same type of propulsion that you would find in like a personal watercraft these days. I mean, that's the same type of thing. I mean, they don't have a propeller sticking, or a prop rather, sticking off the back end of a personal watercraft device.
Yeah.
Because when you fall off of those things, you don't want this thing coming back at you because they circle around to pick you up.
Right. You don't want to get sliced.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's so many safety things built into those. I mean, you wouldn't believe it, but there's safety issues built in or factors built into those things.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is that they use this type of design that you're talking about. And it has, you know, there is an impeller, but it's inboard. It's underneath and there's an intake grate. And, you know, it runs through the impeller. The impeller pushes the water through the pump housing, and then there's a steerable nozzle that allows the thing to be extremely agile. And that's what, you know, you can find that these personal watercraft, they can turn on a dime, Ben. They're super, super agile and quick.
Yes.
And likewise, with these boats, as we'll find out, which is one of the really, really interesting parts about this whole racing. When you watch them, you're not going to believe what you see, how quickly these things can change direction.
Yes. And as we get into that, I've got to say two things for our viewers who, don't get a chance to see Scott Benjamin's famous notes today. Scott, you have drawn a pretty good diagram here of the engine itself.
I try.
I like to point it out because it's still, I wish more people could see these.
I'm a visual learner, Ben.
You're a visual learner. You're a visual teacher. Wait, visual learner, audio teacher.
Yeah, I think that's tough. It's tough to translate that sometimes. And I hope that, you know, people can get the gist of what we're speaking about sometimes because we do that. If not, you know, look up a jet boat design and find out exactly what, you know, what makes those things go, because that steerable nozzle, that's the key to this whole thing. And there's a little twist to that comes up that we're going to have to mention later. And I promise I will, because it's really, really important.
I want to stay with Sir Bill Hamilton for a second, because, Scott, people were skeptical of this idea. In 1960, a Hamilton jet became the first boat to travel up through the Grand Canyon, and it went down the river through the canyon. So that made the critics quiet.
So it traveled up river.
Yeah.
So extremely powerful.
Yes. And that kind of silenced some of the criticism. And of course, if something can go that fast, then it's, you know, how long is it going to take for people to start racing them?
Not very long. And what they did was they started racing in, I guess you'd call it natural rivers, right? I mean,
yeah.
I guess rivers that occur naturally in nature that, you know, these aren't man-made features to begin with. As we'll find out later, they do race in man-made features. But in New Zealand, around 1980, 81, somewhere in there, that was when they originally started this form of racing, this type of racing. And, of course, I know there were the river rat type boats that would just go upriver, like what you mentioned with the Grand Canyon. So you're going up against a heavy, heavy current, something really, really strong, and you're achieving speeds of, you know, 100 miles an hour, you know, going upriver, which is incredibly fast. That's amazing. So you turn that back around, imagine how quickly you could fly over that. But, I mean, that's almost the speed where you can't see things approaching around the bend. I mean, there's some POV type shots of people doing this in New Zealand, people doing this in the United States, doing it all over the place, really, because, you know, this is spread worldwide at this point. But these river runners, I guess, maybe, I don't know what you would call that type of boat. I think river runners or river rats, maybe.
Yeah.
But they travel upriver with tourists, or, you know, they may have 10 or 12 people on board sometimes.
Sure.
Everybody's wearing a helmet and they're all strapped in well. But they're literally going 100 miles an hour up the river, and it's really shocking to see them. I mean, you wouldn't think that they would be able to, you know, divert around any kind of obstacle that comes in their way, but they're very, very skilled. And,
yeah.
And they do so very well. They thread the needle all the time.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. Thread the needle, which scares me. Get out of my head. That is the phrase I was going to use. And so it's not surprising that these boats could be such a great idea for racing. This goes back to our old friend, the power to weight ratio. Ooh, I almost slipped on that one.
Yeah,
Scott.
Pretty close, but you got it that time. Right? So that's good. So yeah, they're very, very strong boats, right? Because you want to talk about the classes now? I mean,
yeah. Okay, there are two recognized international classes, but I've got a third one to lay on you at
the end. Really? Okay. So these two classes, I mean, I can mention them if you want, or do you want to?
Please.
Okay. All right. So the two recognized or internationally recognized superboat classes right now, which are the ones that race in the series, and we'll get into the course and everything in just a moment.
Yeah.
But we do have to talk about the power of these things, because I think it reinforces you know, just how fast these things can be.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Class A, the engines are restricted to either 6.7 liter or 6 liter engines. And now the 6.7 liter engines, that's a 412 cubic inch engine. So these are big V8 engines.
Yeah, these are not go-kart engines.
Now, these are massive, massive engines, and they've got cast iron blocks and heads for the 6.7 liter. Now, the 6 liter engines, which are 365 cubic inches, those are allowed to use aluminum heads in this racing series. Now, both sizes have to be normally aspirated, and they both use four-barrel carburetors. Now, the fuel is like 100-plus octane aviation fuel that they use in these things, so it's really strong fuel. And typically, now, these engines in just Class A, somewhere around 650 horsepower, Ben. So these are really, really strong, even in Class A. Now, there's one that's above that. Now, the superboats, these are the ones that are, these are the top class, I guess. Now, the engines, or maybe not, I mean, you're going to have another one for me here, but engines in the superboat class have no maximum size, but they have a minimum size restriction. So you can't run unless you have a certain, you know, low end size, I guess. And, these are normally aspirated engines. They have to have a displacement of at least 6.5 liters, which is about a 400 cubic inch engine. The forced induction ones are the smaller engines. They've got a second class of engines. Now, the forced induction engines are 3.8 liter engines, which are 235 cubic inch, again, V8s. But they have to be, again, limited to 3.8 liters. And they're typically fuel injected to run methanol. Now, the small block engines that I just mentioned, those produce around 950 horsepower, Ben, that supercharged or turbocharged version. Mm-hmm. The big block engines that I mentioned earlier on, the ones that, you know, the 6.5 liters, they have to produce, or they typically produce somewhere between 1,000 and 1,400 horsepower.
Which is just, again, these boats, I want to make sure we said this. These boats are only about 13 to 13 and a half feet long, so about around 4 meters.
Yeah, picture a wider aluminum fishing boat. Yeah. Something like that. That's probably the best way to say it. They're wide because they have two people and a giant V8 smacked into the back end of the thing with, you know, this whole jet propulsion
1400.
Thing. 1400 horsepower on that. And it's only carrying two individuals, and it's a flat-bottom boat, so, you know, it's got a little bit of a V hull to it.
Yeah.
But it is going to move fast.
I read a pretty neat thing where they said that the race format, has two classes, insane and even more insane.
Insane and insaner.
And there's a reason for this, because due to that, steerable nozzle, they're also very, very agile, so it's not quite, you know, like another very powerful engine-based racing would be drag racing by way of comparison.
Sure, yeah.
And drag racing is not agile.
This is very much like the power to weight of drag racing, in not so much like top fuel dragsters or anything like that,
where you get
into those astronomical numbers, you know, with 0 to 100 and 0.2 seconds or something.
Yeah, not quite that, but there is a similarity.
There's a similarity. It's so, so powerful and so strong. But the agility thing, that's where this is really, I mean, this is so interesting to watch, Ben. And I think we should talk about the course a little bit. Oh, you've got.
I forgot. Yeah.
You've got one more class you wanted to mention before we get into the course and the boats a little bit more.
The AFJSA, the Australian Formula Jet Sprint Association, does have a third class. It's not bigger. It's smaller. It's their 350 class. It's their entry level for people who want to get started with jet sprint.
Okay, very interesting. I had no idea there was like a third class that was now I wonder if that's an internationally recognized class.
I don't think it is.
Maybe.
I think it may just be for this association.
Okay, very good. So that's why it didn't come up in the internationally recognized classes, but I'm sure that within each different division there's probably, you know, some type of novice class, or there's probably, I'm sure that they have like a I don't know, what do they call the old timers when they come out and run them? The legends. Yeah, the legends. Or something like that. And maybe they have something like that. I don't know.
I have a question. How long do these races typically last?
Oh,
wait. Should we save that and talk about what the course is like and then say how long they last?
Let's do that. How about that? The courses. Now, the courses are they're handmade. They're man-made, I should say.
Yeah. Now, that's a big switch that happened in the course of jet sprint history.
Yeah, because remember, they started in these natural rivers like we talked about, and they did run, you know, kind of these, it's almost like an autocross course, really, Ben.
I mean, that's a good comparison.
I think there's a lot of different turns and a lot of different twists and things, and you have to learn the course, but, these courses, if you ever take a look at one, you know, just take a moment and look up what a jet sprint course looks like. It's pretty easy to search online, you know, Google the keywords or whatever, you'll find it. But these man-made courses, now they're so strange, Ben, because they appear to be dug out in fields. Now they're just kind of in the middle of nowhere.
They look almost like tiny canals.
It's a good way to put it. It's almost like they're on they're out in a state fairground or something like that, just right in the middle of nowhere. And the interesting thing is they've got so many different twists and turns and little islands that are built in them. It's like a series of, you said, canals. that are all connected, interconnected channels, and they've got a starting point and an ending point. And the ending point usually has a little bit of a turnaround so they can quickly, you know, whip around and stop at that point. But a start line, a stop line. And within these courses, Ben, like in that small area, and it only covers an area that's about the size of a football field.
Yeah.
But it's very complex in the way they're laid out. Sometimes they will be asked to make 20 to 30 different direction changes in that space. And that means, you know, left turn, straight ahead, go around that corner, left turn again, you know, that type of thing, you know, back and forth. Just honestly, that quick. They travel at speeds up to 80 miles per hour and the whole race is over in less than a minute.
Yes, the entire race takes just 45 to 60 seconds. Now, we mentioned already there are two people on the boat. The team would be the driver, right?
Yeah.
Or the pilot, if we do want to keep with the jet motif, and then the navigator. And the navigator is kind of like, think of sort of a spotter for a snipe team. They communicate through hand signals. So this is what gets me. I'd love to be a fly on the wall in this. I shouldn't be a navigator. I would not know what I was doing because it seems like they have to really memorize the course.
Yeah. And can I just add one little caveat to this?
Yeah.
Now the course, even though it looks complex and you'll see that, I mean, 20 to 30 different changes of direction, complete changes of direction in that 1 minute time. So you can imagine how quickly they're flying around.
Yeah.
These things would make anybody sick, really. They're only handed the course map because it changes every single race. They're only handed that course map minutes before the race. So the navigator has to learn the course and memorize it and then convey it to the driver with hand signals during that 1 minute, it, somehow effectively, so that they make it. Because if they miss one, they're out. You know, that's done. They're disqualified or they suffer a penalty, I think.
Here's my question.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's say you and I are a jet sprint team.
Sure.
All right, let's say you're driving.
Okay.
And for some reason, I'm the navigator.
Okay.
How will you drive that quickly with that many changes and see the hand signals?
You know, I've been trying to figure this out over and over again, and I've been watching videos. You know, I've been watching a lot of these videos, and I've been trying to pick up on the subtlety of what the navigator is doing in front of the driver because they're side by side. They're shoulder to shoulder.
Right.
In this boat. So the navigator isn't really, they're not speaking. They're giving hand signals, and I think it's just a matter of keeping the hand forward. It's kind of like, you know, your hand is your palm is to the side.
So it's like peripheral vision?
Exactly, peripheral vision. I think he's watching the course. He's also watching the navigator's hand at the same time, you know, whether he's indicating left, right, straight ahead. And I just, for the life of me, I can't figure out how they do it. It's amazing because, you know, the track is only about, you know, 5 or 6 meters wide at the widest point. So these are like, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'm going to say ballpark 12 to 15 or 18 feet wide at the most. And so it's a really tight track. They're going 80 miles per hour. They got to make 30, you know, 20, well, let's say 22 or 25, direction changes in 1 minute. And they have to do it without making a mistake. Now, I don't understand how any of this works out. I mean, these guys are professionals. To be able to take a map or a course map that's handed to you just moments before the race and somehow digest all that and remember all those turns, especially when you're out there, because, you know, it's a different perspective from when you're on the boat in the water. Man, this has got to be really tough.
Before we go on, I have to ask for some advice on something unrelated.
Okay, what's that?
All right, Scott, here's the deal. Got some family coming into town, all types. They'll be here for a while. You know I can entertain them. We live here in Atlanta, a mini splendored city, but, they've been here before, man. I don't know how the weather's going to be. I just want to curl up maybe by a fire. We can watch a movie and eat some popcorn or something.
Sounds great. I've got one that the whole family could probably watch. I mean, it's a PG-13, so it's a little bit limiting, but I don't know. I think this will be all right. I've got a decent selection, I think.
All right,
we talk about cars a lot. We talk about trucks. We talk about boats and trains. And
if it flies, drives, or floats.
And airplanes. You just said flies, right? So airplanes, that's where I'm kind of going with this one because the movie that I've picked is The Red Baron, and it is from 2008, and it's based on the true story of the notorious World War I flying ace, you know, and his in this movie. It's kind of an action drama movie, so it's a little bit, you know, there's a little bit of Hollywood made up stuff in here, but not a whole lot. It's mostly factual about the about the Flying Ace, and explains pretty much the life of, I think the guy's name was Manfred von Richthofen, I think maybe, is that how you say it? And he basically was the Red Baron. Everybody knows the Red Baron.
Sure, yeah. Daredevil of the skies. He was a scourge of because he was a scourge of the British, wasn't he?
Exactly. But you know what? He was he from his very early childhood. I mean, he had a fascination with flying, and he became like this renowned pilot. And really, he was pretty young, Ben. I found out later, and just that he died at age 25. Which you wouldn't expect. I mean, you would think that a guy with this type of history, people still know the Red Baron by name, I guess. You know, they know the Red Baron.
Sure.
Maybe not his real name, but they know the Red Baron. And this is what, 90 years later?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that we're talking. So, you know, the legend has lived on. And, I guess he was the top ace, it was credited with something like 80 combat victories in the air.
Wow.
Which is incredible, Ben, because, you know, to be an ace, I think there's kind of a, and I looked this up, you know, to find out what exactly it takes to become an ace. Now, he had 80 victories, and now you have to win, I think it's like 5 or more air victories to be considered an ace in your career, your entire career.
Oh.
So five air victories, like you shoot down 5 of their planes in air-to-air combat,
sure.
In dogfight or whatever.
Versus 80.
Exactly. Now, some people have become an ace in a day. Which happens, it's not all the time, but it became more common during World War II. It was a little more rare before that point, and of course, obviously with, you know, in World War I, I mean, come on. And yeah, in the age of the technical, like the newest, latest technical jet fighters, you know, it's even more difficult. There's less of that going on now.
Sure.
To be honest. But the thing that I think people are going to love about this movie is that there are tons of flying scenes, just lots of dogfight scenes that are just incredible because any of the scenes that I watched, the sky was just loaded with these biplanes and the triplanes, you know, the ones with the three wings, like
that's
the type he flew.
Uh-huh.
Just incredible dogfight scenes throughout this whole movie. And I think it's really something that our listeners are going to really, really enjoy.
I'd love to see that. I think my family would enjoy that too. You got a couple history buffs there.
You know, I think so. And I mean, it's not necessarily like a Christmas movie or anything like that, obviously.
But, yeah.
But I mean, I think it's an interesting story. And I think people will really kind of latch onto this one.
Yes, and speaking of something being worth it, I want to address a question that some of our listeners unfamiliar with Jet Sprint would naturally have.
Mm-hmm.
They heard they heard us say a race generally takes 45 to 60 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So your immediate question is, well, why the heck would I go watch, you know, why would I pay money for this 60-second race, which is, you know, part of the reason some people don't ride roller coasters. Why would you wait in line for something that's so short? But the good news is that these races are always multiple race events.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's like a weekend long event type thing that happens, you know, and they're heat races that come down. And you're trying to beat the clock, really.
Yeah, and there are qualifiers.
And the course is always changing. And, you know, the teams are, you know, they're all different. I mean, there's a lot of different boats that are running in. It's not like 3 boats are going to run the whole weekend. You're going to find that, you know, there's a lot of competition and the boats themselves are really interesting. And when you said that, you know, these courses are really shallow. I mean, we mentioned that, you know, a lot of times they go out into a field and they literally dig these with a bulldozer,
mm-hmm.
and they dig the right channels and they fill them in with water. And so what you're looking at is a bunch of really like low, like real shallow channels that these things are running in. They don't need a lot of water to run in. So
right. That's
all they need. That's kind of keeps it safe a little bit. You know, they can do it anywhere really. There's a couple of different courses around the world really that are permanent, but you know, a lot of them are temporary. So you'll find that, you know, when the track, I guess the equivalent to track workers, I don't know what they would call these really, the safety officials.
Yeah.
They kind of stand out on these islands and they're always very watchful because, you know, when the boats do crash and they do come out of the water sometimes, this shouldn't be too shocking. That's why they have the roll bar on top of them.
Fairly frequently.
I mean, yeah, fairly frequently. That's probably a better way to say it, Ben. But a lot of times when they come out, they just kind of skid out on top of the ground and that's it. And there's not a whole lot to it. I mean, they're not really tumbling and flopping or anything like that. You don't see a lot of spectacular over-end type crashes.
But you do see a lot of things like that because the power of these engines will sometimes just launch the boat.
Yeah, it just shoots them right out. Now, remember, if you're digging something in a flat field and you've got, you know, you've dug it out with a backhoe or whatever.
Sure.
Or a bulldozer, and then you fill it with water, you're pretty much at ground level. So when they do go out of the water, they just tend to skirt right out onto the surface of the mud or the grass or whatever's around them. And it's really, there's not a whole lot to do with it. So, you know, it's relatively safe for the drivers. There's very rarely any time when a boat actually flips over, because they're wide and they're sturdy. They're firmly planted in the water, I guess, if that's the way to say it.
One other thing that I thought was interesting, at least in, this Australian association that I was reading about, I believe they have, five permanent tracks. So it'd be Tweed Coast, Griffith, Maryborough, Melton, and Temora. Mm-hmm. I'm apologizing for mispronouncing all of those, right? But they weren't on our pronunciation list from earlier.
No, that's right. They were on our Australian pronunciation
yes.
list.
But but what's interesting, at least in that association, is that you can have two teams per boat. So you can have a competition with, you know, Josh and Chuck from Stuff You Should Know driving the boat one time, and then, you know, Scott and Ben from Car Stuff driving the boat.
So we could have a How Stuff Works boat, and we could have several podcast teams competing in that same boat against each other on the same course.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
Two teams per event, though, so you can't have a boat that everybody is on.
Well, understood. Okay,
so I think that'd probably be bad for the engine itself.
Well, probably. Yeah. A little bad for everybody, right? I mean, you don't want everybody using the same boat, maybe. That'd be a little tricky to run. But
no nitrous oxide either.
No nitrous oxide. Okay. All right. Fair enough. So normally aspirated or carbureted. We mentioned that some are, I think there were some that were fuel injected, right?
Yeah.
Some that were supercharged. Mm-hmm. In the, I think it was in the Australian series. Anyways, there's also the United States Sprint Boat Association, or the USSBA, if you want to check out some stuff here, because the Pacific Northwest, I think, is where they run a lot of the jet sprint competition here in the United States. So if you're interested in it there, check it out. You know, you can find out stuff, you know, information from the USSBA. Okay, last thing maybe, Ben.
Okay.
Because I think we've kind of covered this, and it's really, really cool. And that we say this so many times, but the only way to get the idea across here.
Oh, yes.
For our listeners to really get a feel for what we're talking about here, because it's such a huge adrenaline sport. Check out, you know, any kind of video you can about jet sprint racing or jet sprint boat racing or whatever they call it. I mean, I think jet sprint is probably the way to say it. And that'll get you where you need to be.
I think we can take this a step further, Scott, because I think that when this podcast comes out, if you're listening to it now, you can go to our blog on carstuffshow.com and just search for jet sprint, and we'll lay out some of our favorite jet sprint videos. So you won't have to waste time weeding through the horrid stuff. We'll just show you the highlights.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Maybe some of the stuff where they harmlessly skirt themselves up onto the grass or whatever, you know, some of that type of stuff too. We'll throw that in there.
Can I tell you something funny?
Yeah.
I'm not going to mess with the videos when I post them up here, but there were a couple where, the people are going so fast, you know, in the race, and then someone skirts over the top. That in my head, the Benny Hill theme song was playing because it just matches some of it so much.
It does seem like that, like those crazy chase scenes that he would have. Yeah, exactly. I understand what you're talking about. Now, you know, just one last thing before we move on here, because I mentioned this earlier and I forgot to get to it, but we were talking about the whole propulsion thing with the steerable nozzle and the impeller and the pump housing and all that, how it works, right?
Yeah.
And how cool the propulsion system is on these boats. And I think that in itself is probably a full podcast. Really, but one thing that you realize like quickly is how fast they can turn. I mean, they're just like turn on a dime type things in the water, which you'd never ever expect.
Yeah, not an exaggeration.
It's nothing like a prop boat where, you know, if you're going 80 miles an hour, you have to make a big arcing turn.
Yeah.
If you turn the wheel, you're going whichever way you turn the wheel, and immediately. And so the faster you go, the faster you turn. And the thing about these is now, I kind of looked into the jet drive system and to find out just why they're exactly so maneuverable, because it's shocking how maneuverable they are. They only really work, the turning system in these things, you know, the steerable nozzle thing, it only really works when you've got power going through it.
Yes.
So if you're going slow, if you're just idling and you turn the wheel, it's going to take you a long time to turn. It's going to be a slow progression. But if you are going fast like these guys are in these courses, the faster you go, the more maneuverable it becomes. And I think there's probably a point of return there,
like diminishing return.
Yeah, exactly, diminishing return. That's what I meant. But the faster you go, the better you turn. So you know, it's to their advantage to be able to go 80 miles an hour on these courses because you know you're able to turn just as fast as you want to. So you turn the wheel left, you immediately go left. You turn it right, you immediately go right. But the slower you go, the less that effect becomes. So, you know, it pays off really for them to go as fast as they do.
I bet if we graph that, there's got to be some sort of sweet spot. You know, I bet it's possible to calculate the maximum speed for maximum maneuverability.
And they probably know it.
And they, oh yeah, they,
I
yeah,
mean, these
of course
guys,
they already know.
These engineers, of course they know exactly what's going on. Cause these things aren't put together in backyards by a lot of people. I mean,
yeah.
Some are, I shouldn't say that. Some are. Others are professionally built, you know, with the matching trailer and the travel system. And
I mean, they're all types.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just like any kind of other racing where, you know, you've got the ultimate top end level and then you got the guy that puts one together in his garage and does just as well.
Yeah. And that's what I like. That's what we like about a lot of racing or types of racing. We love it when a race is accessible to everyone, not just as an audience member, but as a driver or an engineer, if you want it bad enough, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, and these boats seem simple enough to put together as far as, and I don't mean to downplay it, but there's really not a whole lot to them when you look at what's going on. I mean, they're big and powerful, and they've got an advanced system for propulsion,
mm-hmm.
but it seems like you could really put one together that can compete well at the local level, at least.
Well, let's just find a bulldozer and dig up the parking lot, see what happens. That is probably not what we're going to do, but we are going to head out. Rudy, thank you for this excellent suggestion. Scott, let's see. Do we have anything that we want listeners to send us this week?
Yeah, let's see. How about some email? I don't know, maybe some tweets or something.
Oh yeah,
that's a little bit of a little back and forth on Facebook. How about that?
Yeah, we do love hanging out on all three of those places. You can check out our carstuffshow.com website. That's right, we are moving up in the world for more information about Jet Sprint. And if you want to send us an email directly, Scott, where should they send the email?
Carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.